The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network. Good evening. You are tuned in to Race Treaty right here on the Black Talk Radio Network. Today's date is December 18, 2015. My name is Scotty Reed, and I'm filling in for Brother Robin, who is your normal host. Brother Robin is in transit right now out on the road, and he was going to attempt to do his program, but he ran into some unexpected equipment problems, so I'm filling in for him tonight. Tonight, we do have a guest for you. We will be speaking once again. She is no stranger to the network, no stranger to Race Treaty, but we are speaking tonight to Dr. Vernelia Randall, and we are going to discuss human rights and her latest work in that area. She just recently returned from Iran and presenting a presentation to a university there on human rights, and she has always been involved in working at the UN level. She will be speaking to us about the UN working group of experts on people of African descent, who I understand will be visiting the United States. Dr. Randall is a professor at a school of law since 1990. She writes extensively on and speaks internationally about race, women, and healthcare. Thank you for joining us tonight, Dr. Randall.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate another opportunity to be on with you all. It's always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have you. So let's jump right in. I understand from Brother Robin that you recently returned from Iran. Can you tell us about that trip? What was it about, and what do you think was accomplished there?
Well, what happened is this NGO, non-governmental organization in Iran, called New Horizon Conference, put on a conference called On the Brink that was all about African descendants in the world, and particularly African descendants in the United States. They invited and brought over about 15 to 20 African descendants, mostly from the United States, some from Canada, some from Europe, and some from Africa. The first 4 days was everybody providing a presentation. I actually did two presentations during the conference. Most people did one, but I did two. I did one on the school-to-prison pipeline, and I did one on health disparities. An amazing brother from Europe, a young African American male called Kendi Saba, I believe it is, did an amazing presentation in French when they had translators there, and then he transferred to English, and the focus of his presentation was on Let Black People Be Black. And his whole voice was, yes, we need help, he was born in France, he has a French name, he was raised in France, but he is Black. And that anyone who is going to help us, like the Iranians can't expect us to be Iranians, or that we are black people. So the Nation of Islam had a number of representatives there. The American Human Rights Institute had a number of representatives. The American Human Rights Institute messages was basically around the need for African Americans, or African descendants in America to, move towards international law for self-determination. And the whole point, really, I give the Iranians this, they did an amazing conference. They brought in academics like myself, they brought in community organizers, they brought in artists, and the Davises were there, and they're educators, and so they it was all about what is the problem going on there, and what can Iran do, what more could be done by Iran to help us kind of address some of our issues.
Well, I was just, Dr. Randall, I was just thinking that very question in my mind. And I'm sure some of the listeners, you know, who may not be that well educated on the international framework of human rights, but, you know, whether it's Iran, whether it's, you know, another country. I know Venezuela has also called out the United States government for its mistreatment of African descendant people, as well as immigrants coming from south of the border and whatnot. So how can they help us here in the United States?
Well, the first thing was just having that conference. And I tell you, one of the things, they put a lot of money into this conference.
Okay.
They actually had a professional level videotaping during the entire conference.
Okay.
And by the time we left, they gave all of us the complete conference on disc for our use. An amazing tool. I actually put it up on my website, racism.org. I broke up the speeches into different, so that you don't have to go through 4 days worth of speeches, but you can look and find one. Mm-hmm. But on an international level, the United Nations, individuals only can file a complaint if their country will allow them. United States is one of the few countries that will not allow it.
File a complaint where?
In the International Human Rights Court.
Okay. All right.
So we sign all these treaties on human rights, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And there's a lot of reasons why they're more for show in America than anything else. One reason is whenever we sign a human rights treaty, I'm using the royal we. Whenever the United States signs a human rights treaty, they always put restrictions on them that basically boils down to, don't get excited. You're not getting any more rights than what our Constitution allows. Mm-hmm. So what the problem with that reservation is, unlike many constitutions in the world, our constitution does not provide for any human rights. None. We are not guaranteed any human rights. We're guaranteed due process of law, but you're not guaranteed housing and food and education. There's no right to an education in the American Constitution. So basically then, by putting that limitation on, the other countries cannot force the United States to abide by the treaty if the United States says that our Constitution don't allow us. One big area where that goes on is in the area of hate speech. The United States constantly refuses to do anything about hate speech, even though other countries keep demanding it. And they basically said, sorry, our constitutional won't allow it.
On top of that, now, Dr. Randall, I would say that they refused to do anything about white terrorism, let alone even acknowledge that white terrorism.
They don't call it terrorism. Yeah. They call what has happened in this country is terrorism has one definition, mm-hmm. Muslims.
Right.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is hate crime or just crime.
Mm-hmm.
So you can walk into a store, you can bum like was it McVeigh? You can bum a federal building as a white male, which did happen sometime in the 2000s or the
1990s during the Clinton administration.
Yes, and everybody, no one calls that terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
But back to the human rights thing, what Iran can do. So the United States has not authorized us to be able to file individual complaints against the United States, which if they had authorized, you could file a complaint. I could file a complaint,
mm-hmm.
about what's happening in the United States. So that means that we need countries to speak up for us. I mean, we go to the meetings and we speak up at the meetings as NGOs. But it's not as an NGO. We're always taking part as a sort of a stepchild part,
right.
You know, we get voice, but we have no power.
Right. Sort of like Washington, D.C.'s elected representative has no power in Congress.
Exactly. Exactly. But nations do have power.
Okay.
And if enough nations were to start doing something, not mm-hmm. just complaining,
right.
but doing something, and Iran by bringing focus on this, and one of the things that have come out of this is their national news entity is going to start running regular articles written by African Americans mm-hmm. on what's happening in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we said to them is, because Iranians, you know, they're going through their own thing with the United States. And
right.
I'm like, you know, this is not new. You think it's you, but it's how the United States relates to any entity they want to oppress.
Right.
It's how they relate to us.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things is if you want to understand the United States, look at how they treat their own people.
Right, right. Exactly. You know, particularly if we're talking about non-white, non-Christian nations.
Exactly.
Okay. Got you. I follow.
Exactly.
You. Mm-hmm.
So I left there, and I left there with a butter. Nina, having said this, my time in there was very supervised. The Iranian government will not allow Americans, Canadians, or English people to travel around the country without a guide.
Okay.
So you either have to be in an authorized tour group or you have to have a private guide. Essentially, we were always in a group, and we were in a group where they wanted to take us. And we got to see a lot of the country and got to talk to a lot of people. But as I told them, and I said this over and over again, I said it to them, and I think the Iranians are amazing people. I think they're some of the warmest people that I know and sincere people. But I really didn't get to talk to the oppressed people in their country.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into a discussion with one of the young women there and one of the Americans, black women who were there. And it was, I mean, Tehran was beautiful, large, 16, 18 million people, a beautiful city. And the people are really hospitable. And there are food markets everywhere. I mean, just fresh food markets everywhere. So there was a lot to be admired by the country. But we were talking, and I said, well, you know, you keep asking me what I think of Iran. I said, what I've seen, I'm really impressed. But I can't formulate an opinion until I see how the poor live, how the Bajas, which is are oppressed in your country, live, and how and women who don't agree with the dress code. I need to be able to talk and have a fuller picture. And so the young woman who I was talking to got very excited about the country being able to protect themselves and their young people and their culture. And that's why, because I talked about the lack of the internet being restricted. And and so the young black woman who was sitting with me, and many of them were really enthralled with Iran. And I'm not dumping on Iran, because I really think that there's a lot to admire. But
you're
said,
trying to take a realistic, objective view.
Exactly, you know. And so I said, so when she said to me, she said to me, well, people who don't like it can just leave. And the young black woman said, yeah, that's right. This is a great place. People who don't like it can leave. And I stopped her right then and I said, wait a minute. How can you say that? That's exactly what they say to us.
Exactly.
Furthermore, they could do exactly, Americans can do exactly what the Iranians have done. They can bring over a group of people, show them nothing but middle class black people, show them nothing but the best neighborhoods, show them nothing but the best part of the quote black community. And people would walk away thinking, why are black people upset?
Why are they complaining? Yeah.
Why are they complaining?
And we hear that often from, you know, in the black community when we're talking about non-U.S. blacks, where we're talking about people coming here from Africa, and they had this false view of America being this land of opportunity. And then, you know, they come over here to go to school or to start a business, and then they wonder, you know, well, what are we complaining about? What are you
What's
complaining
the problem?
About? Yeah.
They come over from having been the middle class of their community, working class, not
the poor,
not the dirt poor of their community.
Right.
They come over here with some education, some skills, some things,
resources.
And they, you know, so I said, you can't do that. You can't just judge a whole society. Every society has oppressed people, and there's nothing inherently bad because of that. What's bad is how they treat those people and what they do to undo the oppression.
Understood.
And so without being able to see those people and talk to them, I can't make a total judgment about. But that doesn't discount what they're doing for us.
Right. I understand.
And even the reasons, I mean, to be fair, it's political.
Right.
I mean, you know, the United States puts out reports every year on every country in the world except the United States and how they are dealing with human rights. And so Iran is one of the countries we've decided to pick on. And so why wouldn't they say, wait a minute, why are you going to pick on us? Your house isn't particularly clean.
Right. And I understand you made a very important point that I want to reiterate. And we see the same thing with the Chinese as well when they point fingers at the United States and how they treat African descendant people here. But even if their reasons for doing so isn't pure and it's political, it still can be a benefit to us, is what I think
absolutely.
I hear you're saying, and I would agree with. It doesn't matter what your intention is. What matters is the outcome or the outcome we're aiming for.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is can Can we use it is the question. And will we use it? I like the brother's comment, let black people be black. So if the Iranians' idea is that we're going to be more like them, then that would be shedding one slave master for another slave master.
Exactly. I just had that conversation. I love that phrase, and I am going to have to use it. Let black people be black. As I was having a conversation on my program, Black Talk Radio News, earlier today, and I was talking about, and this just happened recently, but it's the reason why I left Blog Talk Radio, is because people got upset with the name Black. Black Talk Radio. I mean, what's the big deal here? You know, we chose Black Talk Radio because black people don't really have a whole lot of talk radio where they're discussing serious issues and not just focusing on entertainment and dating and jokes and stuff like that. And so I like that. Why can't we just be black? Just let us be black. Self-determination, you know?
Yes. Yes.
I like that. Let black people be black.
You need to hear you. I really encourage you all to go to racism.org and go to the On the Brink conference. And there's about at least a dozen separate presentations. So you may not want to listen to them all, but you need to listen to his.
Okay. I definitely will check that out.
And he's in French for the first half, so you won't understand what he's saying. But I tell you where to go to hear him start speaking in English.
Okay.
He's a young brother, about 33, 34. But he was powerful.
Now, since our time is kind of short with you tonight, again, you know, we appreciate you joining us for any amount of time. But before you leave, I do want you to talk about the UN working group of experts on people of African descent that will be coming to the United States. And what first two questions, what is, for the people who don't know, is the UN working group of experts on people of African descent? And the second question is, what is their intent with this visit?
Okay, so the United Nations put together working groups of experts who, at the invitation of the country, they can never go in unless the country invites them.
Okay.
Now, so the fact they're coming
It's a big deal in itself that they got permission to come.
It's a big deal in itself because it meant the United States. And this is actually their second visit.
Mm-hmm.
They are coming largely, I think, because of all of the killings and murders lynchings that have been going on by police. The mass incarceration of black people in slavery, and all of those things. So they're going to be here for about 11 days.
11 days.
And they're going to Baltimore, Ferguson. I think they may be going to Chicago and Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know their schedule, and then they haven't put that out, and I don't know how people can get involved in it. The U.S. Human Rights Network has information on it, and if you go there, you might be able to find information about when are they going to be here and their schedule. The U.N., after the World Conference on Racism, what in 2001, one of the things that we lobbied for is a specific focus on people of African descent. And they formed this working group of experts. And what this working group of experts does is they meet annually, first of all. And I used to go pretty regularly to their meetings, but it's in Geneva, and it's really, you know, that's a lot of time and money.
Right.
But they take testimony, they study an issue, and they provide reports to the UN on what's happening with people of African descent. people of African descent all over the world, not just in the United States. So they take a really broad look, including people of African descent in Africa. When they come here, so they're going to come here to study the problem and to take testimony. And then as experts on this, they're probably going to send 3 or 4 people. And the experts on women just left. And so they're going to go back with recommendations. Racial Justice Now, a community organization that I helped form here, we wrote a report on the status of African descent. The focus of our, and submitted it to the working group. We want the United Nations and the United States to take the first step in my mind towards self-determination, although we didn't talk about it in that way. The first step is acknowledging that DAEUS, that is D-A-E-U-S, DAEUS, descendants of Africans enslaved in the United States, is a special group that deserves special recognition, that we are unlike any other group here that has a minority status. We are, in fact, natives to the United States of America because we exist nowhere else within the United States of America. We have heritage from the continent of Africa, but we can't pinpoint. Because of slavery, we were stripped of everything, mashed together as a group. We united with we had a lot of different groups that came into us in terms of their culture and history and everything because of the one drop rule. And people of African descent in the United States are not African. They are people of African descent. We're not European. We're not South American. We're not Native Americans. We are people of African descent. We think that the United States should put something on the census and should stop counting and knowing what's happening to us as a group, just like they know what happened to the Japanese American, Chinese American. They have every ethnic group broken down for Asian Americans. They have ethnic groups broken down for Latinos. We think they should break down the ethnic groups for Black Americans, and that one of those groups should be DAEUS.
I think we got Brother Robin was able to get to a phone, and he is on the line. Go ahead, Brother Robin.
Well, thank you. Thank you for gracing us with your presence, Dr. Randall. It's been a while, and I was excited to find out about your travels and your insight into the decade. And the DAEUS is really, really important. You brought it to my attention as a definitive description of those of African descent here in America, wherein we notice that there are those of African descent from the Caribbean and other places that man the positions in higher learning here in the United States, but in fact, they're not actually descendants. They're not actually DAEUS. And I would think that would apply to President Obama as well, although no, they claim to his mother.
Well, this is what I said in the report. Black Americans, rightfully so, means anybody of Black ancestry who's in America.
Right.
African American, I thought, was an attempt to identify DAEUS, but still people put every Black person into that. And it becomes a self-identifying one. Are you African American? Yes. Why? Because I say I'm African American. Mm-hmm. But DAEUS, descendants of Africans enslaved in the United States, describes our group very specifically
and also sets up the criteria for being in it.
Okay.
And that criteria is that you have an ancestor that was in this country at a time when slavery occurred. Mm-hmm. And you would know that by the fact that you had a grandfather born in 1910 and 1920, because they didn't let Africans into this country. And so anybody who has a relative, a black relative, that was born any time, I'd say, before the 1930s, is someone who, more likely than not, is a descendant of an African enslaved in the United States. It's possible that some rare occasion, somebody was a freed person from the 1472 and only married freed people, and so that their whole line consists of freed people. But that would be such a rare thing.
Right. For example, doing my own research on my own family history, I found out that, you know, through our namesake, that we were not enslaved, and it was actually a lot of free Africans here that also fought in the Revolutionary War from North Carolina. I'm in North Carolina, and this is just recent history that I have uncovered. Well, not recent history, but history I recently uncovered. But then, like you just mentioned, I'm glad you put that qualifier in there. They, of course, probably more than likely married, you know, other African descendant people who were enslaved. As a matter of fact, I'm sure that's the case. So it would be pretty rare, you know, for somebody to not have an enslaved African, somebody black, you know, to not have an enslaved African in their family tree.
And we can just make the assumption that they do. Furthermore, I think that even for that rare person, they were here during, their freedom was very tenuous and not free.
Right.
I mean, and so I think descendants of Africans enslaved in the United States, we put Africans first because we want to emphasize our African humanity. And not our enslavement. And so that's why it's D-A and not D-E.
So could we describe...
And in the United States, because there was slavery in all over
the planet,
the world.
Right.
Enslavement of Africans all over the world, including Europe.
So we can say that this group that's coming here to the United States is actually on a fact-finding mission on the mistreatment of African descendant people on this continent, and they will take back their findings to the UN. And what would we want to see happen at the UN?
Well, what we want the UN to do is then take that into consideration when they make recommendations to the United States on things they need to do. If they find the violations to be onerous, they could even start a complaint process against the United States
on our behalf. Okay.
Start a complaint process.
Dr. Randall, we can't start a complaint process because we're not an identified nation within a nation. Because we're not identified people that it actually has a seat as a nation at the United Nations. And the African American.
And because the United States refuses to allow us.
Yeah, we covered that. She covered that pretty extensively at the beginning of the broadcast.
The United States, individuals from a country, and many European countries and South American countries allow individuals to file complaints.
Okay. But not the United States. Okay. Well, Dr. Randall, I know you said you only had 30 minutes for us tonight, and we certainly appreciate you know, the time that you have given us tonight, but more importantly, we appreciate the work that you are doing on behalf of African descended people. Before you have to leave us, is there anything that, any words that you will, any final thoughts that you would like to leave with the listeners? And again, I want to remind the listeners to go to her website, racism, or is it racism.org?
That's correct.
Yes, it is.
Go to racism.org and take a look at the videos that she posted from the conference in Iran that she had been speaking about, or her trip to Iran that she had been speaking about. So check that out, racism.org. Dr. Randall, did you have any final thoughts to leave with the listeners?
Well, the only thing is I just did a study and presentation, and we are exactly back where my grandparents was in terms of conditions in the United States.
Wow.
Exactly. Hmm. I mean, it is horrifying. And people think that, oh, this is not legal. But the answer is, yeah, it is. Hmm. And that's the problem. And I tell people that in the United States, anything that is not outlawed is legal.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to start with that in your mind.
Right.
If it's not outlawed, specifically outlawed, then that makes it legal.
Right.
And in the United States, discrimination based on implicit bias, discrimination based on negligence, discrimination based on recklessness, none of that is outlawed.
Right. Neither is slavery. Neither is slavery.
And neither is slavery. And that's how come we've got so many people in prison. Because the 13th Amendment basically says except for punishment for a crime. Mm-hmm. So what we have, what are the three pillars of the legal apartheid system that's called Jim Crow? Contract leasing and ways of putting large amount of people back into a form of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Large scale legal discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
And violence.
Right.
State approved violence to keep people
state
in
violence,
their place.
Right.
State
and
sponsored
we've got
terrorism.
All three of those now. Back
yes,
to vengeance. It's like when you take strep throat and you take some medicine but you don't take it all, when it comes back with a vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, because most of us don't recognize it for what it is,
mm-hmm.
it's being unchallenged as a complete system. We keep wanting to challenge little tiny aspects of it
mm-hmm.
instead of saying, no, this is a complete system.
Yeah, it's the same system that white enslavers set up in 1775. It's the same system. Operating the same way.
Dr. Randall, not only is it the same system, but the system from its onset, from its beginnings, not only identified as a three-fifths human, but the Constitution, if we really look hard at it and analyze that, it has no social or economic rights afforded under the Constitution.
Right.
I said that one of the basic problems with our Constitution is that there's no human rights in it.
None.
And that's because, think about it, Constitution was made by rich, white, land-owning men
right.
who did not want to pay taxes. That is literally mm-hmm. why they went to war.
Right.
They went to war because they had started wars that England had to protect them from.
Mm-hmm.
And then when England said, we're going to raise your taxes to help pay for the war, they said, hell on with that.
Right.
And they went to war to keep from paying taxes. So they made a constitution designed to assure that they pay minimal taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that applies to human rights, too. The treaty that they signed, they don't compile the data needed to indicate if there's disparate outcome, the disparate impact, and disproportionality. The U.S. doesn't even self-regulate itself to compile the data for standards of human rights, which we see in the headlines is violated daily.
And they don't sign. I mean, like, we have not signed the rights of the child. We have not implemented
the only country in the world
to protect the rights of
the child. Wow. I was just on a previous a person I'm connected to on social media. Her name is Paige Madison, and she was doing a video chat tonight, and we were just having that conversation, and that was brought to my attention about they haven't ratified, you know, the treaty on children's rights and whatnot, and I did not know that. But here is another thing. This is what something that
you know. I'm sorry. I'm really kind of starting to fade out now.
Okay,
I hate to interrupt. But I'm going to talk to you soon,
Dr. Randall. We'll talk to you very soon.
I'd love to be back on again.
All right, Dr. Randall. Well, we'll certainly be in touch. And you have you get some
rest, Dr. Randall, and
have a good night.
Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye, Brother Robin.
This is
what concerned me, and I'm hearing more and more of this, and I'm sure you have heard it, but I'm hearing these people, and it's a true, what the statement is true, and the statement is that race is a false construct, or a social construct, or a political construct, and that's true, especially, you know, for those who are knowledgeable, or have listened, or read the book, The Invention of the White Race. And how all these Irish and Scottish and poor English peasants became white here in America. Well, that's true. Okay. But it's a little too, this is my thinking. It's a little too late in the game now for you to be trying to do away with racial classifications for the very reason that you brought up about them not, you know, about the data. Okay, if you do away with racial classifications, let's just say, for example, in Texas. Now, I have to find the source of the information, but, you know, I just got bits and pieces. But a law was passed in Texas, from my understanding, that required police officers to check off the racial classification of the people that they were stopping. Because they were being, you know, of course, accused of racial profiling. And so what they did to get around it, what the cops did, or the troopers, or whoever it was that this applied to, is they were stopping black people or Hispanic people, but then on the form that they had to fill out, they put down they stopped a white person to get away with
it. It's coded. In England, they have the race category so darn coded for law enforcement. It's ridiculous. They speaking of metadata, they're using that to profile, but yet, and I hear what you're saying about the problem with this whole idea, man, is that human rights doesn't apply within the United States is really the bottom line on it.
Brother Robin. These people, and it's not just white people, and it was white people who mentioned it to me tonight about, you know, race being a false construct and we need to do away with it. But, you know, my cousin, one of my older cousins who, you know, I have tremendous respect for, but I think he's coming around now. But he was like saying the same thing. We're all one race. We're the human race. And then on the other side, we hear people, oh, we're all Americans. And
Scotty, I'll buy that, Scotty. I'm looking for the day to buy into that. And that day will be after reparations. Okay. So, you know, we can deconstruct the whole conversation then. But until then, and this includes the proxy races holding up the status quo of white supremacy, you know, until then, we really need to attack it at its core, and that is inside these institutions. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a feeling, it's not an attitude. And the prospect, I mean, the United States has shown its face, white America has shown its face by its response to Donald Trump and his rhetoric, mm-hmm. you know, and his hatred, and his attempting to really shepherd the energy of white supremacy now against, you know, first the immigrants, then the Islamophobia.
Mm-hmm.
We've been there all along. We're the fulcrum, anti-black racism.
Right.
So I'm sorry.
Don't worry about it. I would also say that he's causing the proxy races to show their face as well. So, yeah.
Well, you know, that's a counter argument. Ultimately, yeah, all lives matter, but you know, historically, white lives matter more. Therefore, black lives matter needs to be addressed as a fulcrum, you know, of racism. Anti-black racism is the core. It's not with, and it's an economic base attached to it as well as a system.
But I even find somebody making that suggestion, and I can't speak to the individual. It was my first time in a conversation with them, but it was a white male. And, you know, just based on what I was just listening to them speak, they consider themselves to be progressives and whatnot. And so then when they start talking about that race is a false construct, I even look at that as being racist, because now all of a sudden, you know, you want to say it's incorrect for people to identify as black or to identify as anything they want to identify as, you know. And so, you know, I'm concerned about that seeping into even our consciousness as black people.
Well, it has already. But, you know, you brought up a real good point there. And that is this: they want to do away with these race classifications, because who is really making the race classifications? They're behind the curtain. Nobody realizes that there's a group that are identified and selected to chop up the identity of people in this country, and the movement has been white Latinos, Arabs, and Northern Africans as becoming white. So they're subtly, knowing that their numbers are depleting, are also adding in to the complementary white inclusion of the new immigrants that they select. But who's behind the curtain?
Mm-hmm.
Who's behind the curtain? And before people start identifying, the reality is that it's a really, it's an abstract. Yes, it is. It's a social construct. Well, if you're constructing something, you're building something. What they built with the social construct is white supremacy.
Oh, man, just hit the nail on the head, Brother Robin. And like you said about reparations, okay, let's do away with racial classifications, but
right.
Only after you dismantle the system of white supremacy.
Well, yeah, and the reparations also, you know, they're talking about bringing a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Well, the truth means the data. The reconciliation is after the healing. The healing can't come until, you know, there's anesthetic, sterilize the wound, you know, that, you know, stitch it up, and then it heals. People like to jump to the healing real quick, you know, and not understand that in itself is a process towards recovery, you know, just like restorative justice, you know. So the Human Rights Commission isn't about like a lamentation. It's like we need now. We're not talking about money. We're talking about setting up our own institutions to address our own maladies, first of all,
right?
Foremost, you know. But self-determination cannot be had by dependency. Just like capitalism was built on racism and slavery, they need to ante up. And then we can, you know, yeah, I'm willing to sing Kumbaya after that. But until then, that's a jump in the head.
Say, pay yeah. what you owe first. Pay what you
right.
owe. And
that's
yeah.
called restorative justice, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, most of the prominent groups out of Europeans that were oppressed certainly got reparations. And then the absurdity of even enslavers getting reparations. The enslaved didn't get reparations.
I know. Yeah. The landowners, the white slave owners in the South and not only them, but their partners in Europe as well. See, that reached further than just good old U.S. That network was, that transatlantic slave industry was a network.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you had the Dutch, the English, the Portuguese. Come on now. You know, you got the largest population of slaves were taken to Brazil. We can't even kick it with them because we don't speak Portuguese.
Right.
They got like 10 times more than we got here in America. And we being infiltrated with this African-American label, and we're not even identified. They're identified, the president as an African-American. Okay, well, That's a play on words. Mm-hmm. He has no genetic DNA memory from slavery. And it's a fact that that memory is passed down intergenerationally through the DNA. Mm-hmm. This is why Dr. Randall is on point with the dais. If you're going to identify a specific, you know, because their argument back about reparations is, you know, this, it could be anyway, is, hey, you know, this is a racial construct. Anybody has pigmentation, we can't pay anybody, you know. But the reality is there is a population here that helped build this capitalist system. And they're 400 years off the hook right now.
Helped build? I would say they did about 99.9% of the work.
Oh, no doubt. And the peripheral industries that were generated off of, you know, so we're not included, but they want to tax us. Okay. They want to kill us without due process. Now they're not even bringing us to the station to lie and cheat and lock us up. They're doing it both ways. So they've learned all these ways to commodify the black body, mm-hmm. you know, to continue slavery. Right. Even if it's a species class base, it still exists. But now that, you know, people of European descent, white people are being like knocked out of that middle class and they're joining the ranks of the poor. Now they want to, you know, focus on, we're all human, you right. know,
class,
all lives matter.
Yeah.
And that's a violent response. Mm-hmm. All lives matter. It's a violent response. It's doing away with your whole history immediately. To jump to the healing, mm. all lives matter.
Verbal terrorism.
Without a doubt. You know, and I want to thank you, man, for taking the helm on the show tonight. I kind of got caught up in on the road, thought I could use this high tech, but I didn't. My lighter charger wouldn't even work. So you can be debilitated anytime now with this technology. So.
Well, no problem. I know you had someone, Dr. Randall, scheduled, and definitely yeah. didn't want to miss an opportunity for the listeners to hear from her, and, you know, with the wealth of knowledge and experience that she
profound.
Brings.
Yes, profound. Well, brother man, what I'm looking forward to really focusing on in the human rights, from the human rights lens, is that Afrophobia is going on. And that's worldwide, too. Now, they have different labels on it. We call it white supremacy racism. In Europe, they call it Afrophobia, you know, and it's going on. And it's all being poured into this decade. And so I was still curious to see how the United States is stepping up, or black aid, civil rights organizations or otherwise. Why aren't they, like, having a standard plan to really bring up this this decade, this opportunity to address the world on our conditions?
I have many questions about why they don't do this or do that. I got an email today. I didn't even read all of it. I just read some of it because I was busy doing something else. But I got an email from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. And I'm not sure what it was about. They might have been asking for a donation. You know, it's the end of the year. I think that's what they was asking for. But then, you know, on the network, we got a weekly program called New Abolitionist Radio, where we focus on the 13th Amendment, 21st century slavery and human trafficking. And we identified after the Justice Department did their investigation at Ferguson and documented all of the racism and whatnot, even identified some violations of federal law, although they never launched a prosecution against anybody. They just let the racists retire, you know, and whatnot, or move
right.
on to another job. And so
right.
then, you know, because the drug war is a big tool that they use to put us into modern slavery, I pay attention mm-hmm. to that as well. And then I found out that a anti-drug legalization group sued a legal cannabis dispensary in Colorado. It might have been Washington. Okay, it might have been Washington. I think it was Washington. But they sued them in a civil lawsuit under RICO charges, under the RICO laws, which were used to target, you know, organized crime. You know, people think
right.
of the mob and things of that nature. Well, I don't see nothing more organized than their practice of slavery with the police, with the corporations, all of that. To me, is a criminal conspiracy. But when you see But what I don't, what we said was that, you know what? If we had a bunch of lawyers, or if we had, you know, some kind of organization with a bunch of lawyers, that's what we would do. We would go around the country identifying police department, identifying institutions, and suing them in civil court or under the RICO laws.
I thought that's what the human rights defenders and monitors were about, quite frankly.
I haven't seen anybody launch a case under the RICO laws.
Me either. Well, not only RICO. RICO, but, you know, state-sponsored terrorism.
Right. So,
I mean, but they're the ones that are hiring these races in their police departments.
But what I'm saying is a precedence has been set, because you had this NGO that's against drug legalization win a lawsuit against a legal business. Against a
right.
legal business. And what happened was rather than risk losing the lawsuit, they just shut their doors. The business just shut down. And, you know, it was a newly opened business. And I'm thinking about that, and I'm saying,
that's
know
fantastic.
What? This can...
Well, we really do need a lawfare campaign, because that's really what it's about.
I mean, that would be the perfect thing for NAACP Legal Defense Fund to be working on.
You know, they still stuck on trying to bring us.
But I'm saying, setting aside their ineptitude, setting aside their being compromised.
Proxy racism tendencies.
Yeah. So yeah, proxy racist tendencies. But setting that aside, you know, this is a real strategy.
They have apparatus to do it, but they don't have a constituency to hold them accountable.
Right.
So they select their own cases and agendas, and, you know, that might even be influenced, you know, by handlers.
Right.
You know, because, in fact, you're right. I mean, they should be looking 24/7 into legal loopholes or crevices in this white supremacist legal structure to come back at them. That's why I kind of jumped outside that box and said, well, maybe that can be had in international courts. But now the corporations are suing for human rights in international courts, and we have yet to be able to enter in the international courts other than this lodge complaint.
Wow.
Not as a body of people, as a nation state.
Right, right.
So,
well,
no
brother,
economic base.
Well, Brother Robin, we do got another program. Listeners, stay
yes,
tuned.
Brother.
The Lotus Place radio show is coming up at 10 o'clock. Stay tuned for that. Brother Robin, did you have any final thoughts for the listeners as we get ready to wrap up this weekly?
Just stay tuned in the upcoming weeks as we stay focused on this decade and the destruction and dismantling of white supremacy. Thank you for being on the show this evening, man. Appreciate it.
No problem. All right, folks. Again, peace and blessings to all. Stay tuned for the Lotus Place. You've been listening to Race Treaty.
Me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the rain that blows from the north and south.